Actually, thank you all for coming. I expected I wouldn't have anybody here, and it'd just be me talking to this tape machine. And Barb's husband, who I know she made him come, so. My name is Kent Burgess. I've got a couple of roles here at the village. This summer, I'm co-coordinating the summer program along with Barbara Rossing, and I lived here with my family of three kids and wife from 1986 through 1990, and was the business manager at Holden. I actually left here December of 1990 and went to Billings, Montana, and took over management of St. John's Lutheran Ministries. St. John's originally was a low-income HUD retirement home, has subsequently added a couple of nursing homes, an additional retirement home. We then formed a joint venture corporation with the largest Catholic hospital system in the state and developed a continuing care retirement community. Then took over management of Sapphire Lutheran Homes, which are in the western part of Montana. And then subsequently was asked by the Montana Senate to take over management of Lutheran Social Services. I only say that to tell you that I answer to four boards of directors. So I have really four bosses. And what this session is designed to be is a little bit about boards, whether they be church councils, and I'll primarily focus on church councils. But also about nonprofit boards in general. Now, I'm just kind of curious, did any of you folks serve on a church council? Okay. And are anybody pastors? Do we have any pastors in here? Oh, we got one. Okay. I usually make somebody really mad at these sessions, and it's usually both the pastor and the church council. So, which is usually my goal. So I'm going to ask that if you want to stop and debate a point or argue with me, that we'll just do it right then. So feel free to jump in. Actually, I got 5+ reasons. I started out doing these sessions. I only had 5, and now I'm up to 9. So that's been in arguments I've had with church councils across Montana. I thought I probably also should tell you a little bit about my rich Lutheran heritage. I was raised initially in the Mormon Church. My mother was one of 5 daughters, the only one of 5 daughters not married in the LDS Temple in Salt Lake City. So she raised me in the Mormon Church until I was 8. And then my sister and brother came along, and as far as I could tell, my father had one religion, and that was that he hated Mormons, even though he had married one. And so my mother said, well, the children are going to be raised in the church, and you figure it out. And in my father's wisdom in Boise, Idaho, he figured that the biggest church in town must be the best. And so the biggest church at that time was the Cathedral of the Rockies, a Methodist church. So I was blessed in the Mormon church early on and then baptized at the age of 8 in the Methodist church. Then I married a Presbyterian. And then I went to work for a Lutheran company called the Evangelical Lutheran Good Samaritan Society, and they moved me to a little town in Ohio that only had a Lutheran church. And then we had our first child, and we baptized him in the Lutheran church. So, that's my rich kind of heritage, and I guess I've been in the Lutheran church ever since, and have worked for Lutheran groups and folks. And I'll just tell you, the 4 years I spent at Holden Village changed my life. So I won't talk about that, but I'll just tell you that probably the most significant 4 years of my life. Currently, I said I answer to 4 boards of directors, so I have a sense of what it's like. I also currently serve on 3 boards. I'm on the Montana Hospital Association Board of Directors. I'm on a Health Insurance Trust Board of Directors called the MEWA, Multiple Employer Welfare Association. And I'm on Montana Health Network, which is a consortium of 22 hospitals in central and eastern Montana. I've served on some public boards. I was on Governor Roscoe's healthcare advisory board. Governor Roscoe, Mark Roscoe, is now the head of the Republican Party in the United States. But got to serve on one kind of government board, which was really the oddest experience that I've had, because everybody showed up for the board meetings. They were had to be held in public, and every lobbyist that had anything to do with healthcare was there. If we want, we can take a digression somewhere along the way and talk a little bit about government boards and if anybody ever has to serve like on a county board or something. I think they're singly the most frustrating of all boards. I have served on three church councils. And I'll just say those three church councils were probably the most frustrating board experience I ever had. And so I entitled this session, you know, the five reasons I don't want to ever serve on the church council again. Our organization for, we're owned by 22 ELCA congregations, our governing organization. And we did a session about a year and a half ago called Equipping the Saints. And then this was the first time I did the five plus reasons I never want to serve on your church council. And then all 22 churches invited me to come and work with their church council. The hope is that really what I'm trying to talk about is how do we improve church councils and church council performance. I've also served on three call committees, and I'll just tell you that the call committees were the most wonderful of all experiences that I had within the church, and I think there's some things there. Specifically, it was real clear why we were together, real clear about what we were about doing. And we were going to find and call a pastor. And those call committees bonded. Many of those people became my closest friends in the church. I remember in a split church where I was asked to be on a call committee, and we were calling an associate pastor, and there were some people in the church that didn't want any associate pastor because the first pastor didn't work hard enough, and the budget wouldn't afford it, so their big stink was that there was no moving expenses a lot in the budget for this person, therefore we couldn't call them, and the call committee got together and came up with $3,000 to move this pastor. Those people still in that church remained to me very close in terms of that kind of bonded experience. So it's not that I hate the church. I just don't like being on the church council. And so we'll try to go through what I think the five plus reasons are. The first reason I want to talk about is that I think church councils spend a lot of time going to Abilene, Texas. Has anyone ever seen the training film Abilene? Okay, we got just one person that's seen
it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Great.
And so basically for the rest of you, I'll give you a sense of that in kind of a brief sense, that there's this family, this is going to be a real short sense, there's this family, I don't know, it's probably a 3-4 generation family, and they're out in West Texas somewhere, and it's ugly, it's dry, it's hot, and it's miserable, and they're sitting under a tree though, and they're drinking iced tea, lemonade, and life's not going on too bad, and it's pretty quiet, and everybody's sitting around, and then somebody says, maybe we ought to drive into Abilene. Now Abilene's like 90 miles away or 80 miles or 70 miles away, and it's 110 degrees out, and the car doesn't have air conditioning, and there's too many of them to fit in the car anyway. But somebody says, maybe we ought to go to Abilene. And then somebody else a few minutes later says, well, I'd go to Abilene. And somebody else says, yeah, Abilene would be okay. So all these people pile in this car, it's 110 degrees, no air conditioning, and drive to Abilene. And then we're going to fast forward to, now they're all back sitting under the tree. And they are the single most miserable group of people I've ever seen in my life. And somebody finally angrily says, I never wanted to go to Abilene. Well, I didn't want to go either. And the person who originally said they wanted to go to Abilene says, well, nobody was saying anything, I thought I just offered up. I really didn't want to go to Abilene either. And my sense is church councils spend all their time going to Abilene, mm-hmm. partially because nobody really wants to step up and speak and say what they think. I recently worked with a board of directors And somebody on the board had decided that they needed a two-day board retreat. Now, as far as I could tell, and observing everybody else there, nobody else wanted to go on this retreat. Just this one person wanted to go on this retreat. We had to have a board retreat, and we're going to get a facilitator. And people kept trying to say, well, you know, why exactly? What would we hope to accomplish in the board? What would we do? And then the person that really wanted to really thought that, you know, they didn't have much money, so they all should share rooms together at the retreat, and they should do it on a Friday and a Saturday. Well, as far as I could tell, nobody in that room, one, wanted a retreat, two, nobody wanted to share rooms, and three, nobody wanted to go up on Friday and Saturday night, but no one in that room would speak up and say that. So, they scheduled the retreat, they had it, half the people didn't show up. Had other commitments. So if you ever serve on a church council and attendance isn't very good and people don't show up, it's because they got kind of other commitments. So I'm going to come back to that Abilene sort of context in that I just, in a lot of nonprofit boards and church councils, you end up places that you didn't want to go. And then when you get there, you get kind of angry and mad, because you never wanted to go there to begin with, but you didn't really care enough or have the commitment and passion about the issue to really speak up. Because, you know, frankly, most of us show up on boards and we just really, our one thing is we don't want to get any more work and we don't want to torque anybody off. So we just kind of sit back and we end up in Abilene. The second reason, number two reason is trying to figure out who makes the decisions within the church. And I do another side session, which is pastor as CEO. I think there are two models. Unfortunately, we get those models all mixed up. I actually like the model as pastor as CEO. I would just guess that your senior pastor is your single highest compensated person there. Probably has the most education in the church and probably has the most vested interest. So therefore, is really the acting CEO of the congregation. Now, pastors really hate CEO sort of language. So they use language like, no, I'm but a shepherd of the flock. And I'm here to care for the flock. And those decisions, and those CEO, they have to be made by the church, and I'm but here to serve the church. Then they go proceed to act like CEO. They make whatever decisions they want to make, and the council's all upset. And then when confronted, the pastor says, no, I'm but a shepherd of the flock. So I just think councils need to be really clear about how decisions are made. How are decisions made and who makes those decisions? And what is the role of the pastor in those decisions? Now, if the pastor is not the CEO and is not going to be making those daily sort of decisions, then it just has to be decided who is. And who in default is it most of the time? It's the church secretary. I mean, in reality, most of my experience, the church secretary is the one who's running the church and running the pastor. But the church secretary has been given no power. And so the council's all frustrated about where power is and how decisions are being made. I think you have to be really clear about who makes what decision. The third reason I don't want to serve on the church council is it really wastes my time. And time is really the only thing I have left anymore. And if I'm going to waste time, I'd rather do it in a way that I choose to do it. So what are examples in which church councils, in my experience, have wasted time? There's usually a ton of committees on church councils. You know, there's a youth committee and an evangelism committee and a mission committee and a building committee and a special events committee and a pastoral care committee. And there's all these committees. And then there's a head of all this. So every person on the church council is a head of a committee. And so the council comes together and every committee gives a report. So after opening devotions, every committee gives a report. Now the report sounds just like the last three reports that I heard. Here's my judge of whether a council or a board is effective. If you miss a meeting, have you missed anything? I mean, if you miss two meetings and come back and the conversation is exactly the same as it was before, then you haven't missed anything. And my experience is the conversation is exactly the same. Because each of these committees feel a responsibility to report on their activities. And it usually starts out by, well, we really haven't made much progress on that, but you know, so-and-so is gonna do so-and-so and so-and-so is gonna happen. So the experience is to hear the same thing over and over again. And I just wonder how much of this could be written down. Now, what I do with my four boards is that if it's short enough and it doesn't require any dialogue or conversation, it should be received by all of our boards in writing. I mean, if we're imparting information that we've set Vacation Bible School for this week, that can be imparted in writing. It does not need to be a part of the church council meeting. But people feel a need, I think, as they sit there to be able to respond to what they're doing in their role as church council. I don't know how many church councils' agendas should be mailed in advance of meetings. Most of the church councils I showed up, the pastor was still trying to figure out what the agenda was. Yes?
Are you missing maybe the church council is a bit of a therapy session? People need to share, ventilate, be recognized, pat each other on the back.
Yeah, I struggle though with the sense of how hard it is to get people to serve on the church council. I mean, most people don't want to be on the church council, and I hear people talking about putting in their time. And, you know, I mean, it should be one of the most fulfilling things that you do. So, you know, I think there are probably better places for that to happen than within the business of the church and trying to develop leadership within the church. I would just say, what are the three, and actually I think there are four, depending on the type of board, but what are the three primary responsibilities of a church council? Folks, give me what they think the three top responsibilities are.
The budget.
No.
Salaries?
No.
To represent?
Not in my opinion, no.
To represent the people of feeling out what the congregation, you know, wants, and then bringing that to the council so that maybe something can be acted upon.
That would encompass probably all of my three.
Strategic planning?
That would be one of my three.
Vision.
Then I would combine that with strategic planning. Mission, vision, strategic planning, probably all within the one. So I think the number one responsibility of church councils is set the mission of the organization. And mission leads into vision, mission being, you know, who are we and what we do today. Who are we is really more of an identity statement rather than what you do, but it becomes kind of important to mission. So, you know, who are we and what do? That's the mission. What do we want to be? That's the vision. How are we going to be that is the strategic plan. So to me, that's the number one responsibility, to set the mission of the organization. What's number two?
Communication.
Set days for potlucks.
Hiring and firing
staff. That's the number two responsibility. It's the church council. Now you say, no, it's the call committee that hires the pastor. Well, who appoints the call committee? It's the church council. It usually constitutes members of the church council. Or if you're on another nonprofit board, the number two responsibility, I think, of that board is to hire and fire its executive leadership. And what's the third? Anybody got an idea what they think the third is?
Monitor
what?
Progress towards goals, effectiveness of staff.
I would put that as part of strategic planning. You know, you've got a strategic plan, here's our goals, here's our time frame, here's our vision, you know, how are we gonna measure ourselves about advancing there? I would say the third, and it gets a little murky, is to establish policies of the organization. And I would differentiate between policies and procedures. And that tends to be a little bit different within the church. So here would be an example of a church council meeting that I attended, that I was a part of, and that I really loved. And I lost this meeting. But here was the issue at the church council. Our church had never been locked. Church was always open, had never been locked. And now we had people that didn't seem to be sharing our sense of community, trying to use the church, and things were starting to come up missing. So the decision had to be made whether we were going to lock the church or not lock the church. Now, it seems like maybe a little deal, but it seemed huge to this. And the decision was made to lock the church. To me, that's a policy decision. Now, who locks the church and at what time they lock the church is not something that should consume the council's time. That should be directed to your staff or whoever's going to be in charge of implementation. So that's the difference. How are you going to lock the church, and when you do, is kind of a procedure in terms of implementation. But the policy, the decision about whether the church was to be locked or not, who should that rest with? And if it's important enough, and I put all policies in that regard. Now the fourth that I've added over recent time, and I moved this probably more from church councils to other nonprofit boards, specifically I'd say to the Holden Board, is retention of institutional memory. Especially at Holden, where we have vast turnover of people. I mean, right now, you know, the person who's been here the longest has been here 5 years. If you take the average of the staff that work here, it's probably less than 7 months. If you took all the staff and added it up, that doesn't constitute much institutional memory. And there's a lot of memory developed this place over 4 years. So depending on the organization, I think institutional memory becomes kind of a fourth function.
Can I raise a question?
Yeah.
I mean, I obviously haven't done church councils, but I do a lot of work with nonprofit boards and other public boards and everything. And why do you think that the fiduciary responsibility is not one of the top roles? When you say budget, it falls into his differentiation between implementation and policy. And I think there is a financial oversight role, not necessarily creating and managing, but financial oversight, the fiduciary responsibility that, I mean, particularly in the world we live in today, where clearly a lot of people aren't looking at the numbers very closely.
I wouldn't say it's not important. I would just lump it under the strategic plan. To me, the finance and the budget is a tool. I mean, money is neither good nor bad. It's the use of money that's good or bad. And that money is just a resource. So to me, money is just like diesel oil. And so how are we going to utilize that resource? And that should be addressed in the strategic plan. So, I mean, my sense is a lot of nonprofits, you know, it's easy to do a strategic vision. And there are kind of three questions I ask about a strategic vision. Is it doable? Is it believable? And is it affordable? And the third question becomes part of the strategic vision. It's not affordable. I mean, one, if it's not doable, it's easy to come up with a great vision, but if it's not doable or affordable, then the vision's going to fail. So when I do strategic planning with church councils, and I do that, they, you know, basically those are the three screens I use: doable, believable, affordable.
You must not be a good Lutheran.
And why? Well, I told you, that's why I started with my background. I'm marginal Mormon.
If it's in the eyes of a lot of folks, it comes by faith. And if it's unreasonable, you can't justify whether you're going to do it or not on paper. Because if it's what God wants, you need to go there.
I want you to hold that thought, because that's number 9. Talk about number 9. Did that answer your question about?
It does. There's a stewardship piece, though, that that the affordability question doesn't quite get at for, when I talk about fiduciary responsibility. I mean, people put their money to the church, and they, or any nonprofit, and they have some expectation that somebody is making sure that the way in which that money is being handled is meeting the interest, the vision, the mission, and that's where I see it tied in. But that, but there is a linkage, and there, so you know, it's a good governance kind of issue that it is being, that the kind of policies that guide how money is handled and that kind of stuff is. It's just that I've been working with a lot of retirement boards, so maybe I'll come up
a little bit to the stewardship piece in number seven.
Okay.
The seventh reason. my concern is, though, that the church council becomes the budget.
Yeah, absolutely.
It becomes the ruling issue. And I'm thinking, well, if the budget is what it's about, why is the organization even formed? Right. To be honest, we don't need another church in this country. You know, Vitor, one of Barb's people said, you know, the church is not the fourth part of the Trinity. You know, we do not need that. We do not need another church. And so if the budget becomes the ruling thing, in my experience, is it's been the budget. The budget becomes the ruling factor and not the mission. I mean, you got the whole context of margin before you can have mission, or mission versus margin. That's the debate. I fall clearly down, you know, without a mission, you don't need a margin. You just don't need it.
Margin.
But a margin being a profitable bottom line, a budget that works, a break-even budget. But folks all get caught up in the budget. So you're sitting here talking about money, and you're not talking about what I think are the top three issues that you ought to be talking about, which is, what is the strategic plan? I mean, Peter Drucker says, you know, what he charges $250,000 to do his seminars, and he asks two questions: what's the mission and what's the plan? And people say, well, Mr. Drucker, those are great questions. Let's get back to you on those, because we got this budget deficit over here, and we got, no, you missed it. What's the mission? What's the plan? You answer those two questions, everything else will take care of itself. But you got to answer those two questions first. And we start, where do we start? We didn't collect enough money last month. That's where we start. And I'll get to that in both number seven and number nine.
What do you include in institutional memory? What's your thought on that?
I think about that more in the context of Holden, understanding why this place was built, it's really easy. I'm going to come down to one of my reasons is that the church council focuses on the budget or on the building, and I get nervous sometimes that Holden's going to focus on the buildings and not on the mission. If I read the mission statement of Holden Village, it doesn't have anything to do with buildings. But Work Camp, and I organized Work Camp this year, was all about the buildings. And if buildings take precedence over program, or buildings take precedence over mission, then what this place was all about will be lost. But the people here are faced with deteriorating buildings. So that's what they see, and they don't possess a historical memory. So you need people like the Ronnings, people who've been around a long time, to know, really what the focus of the place was, and to bring that sense of history and voice. I would not have initially put that. I put it at number four, but I've worked with enough boards. The other thing is, why were decisions made? I mean, you know, the only people, when I was the business manager at Holden Village, the only people I could stand to have come back were former long-term staff, because we never did it as well as they did. You know, we couldn't do anything right. And guess what? Now I've returned to the village 12 years later, and I want to point out everything I think is wrong with this village. You know, and we should be doing this, and we should be doing that. When I was here, and I think and go, oh, you sound just like those people. We couldn't stand when you were here. But there is a place for that. But it has to happen, in my sense, in a governance structure. You know, I didn't want to go through life every day hearing about how we didn't unload the luggage, or, you know, I mean, now it's, they don't do Sunday meals like we did. When I was here, we had a big brunch with eggs and all sorts of wonderful things, then a light lunch so we could all go hiking on Sunday, and then the big dinner. And I can't get oriented here this entire week because I want to go hiking on Sunday, but I don't want to miss salmon. You know, so I've got huge issues to deal with. And you know, I never had that dilemma when I worked here. But there's a place for that, and the place for that is in the governance structure. So for me, that's the institutional memory part. Fourth reason, we're only on number four and I got 27 minutes left. Number four, a lousy nominating process.
Is that not five?
Number one was going to Abilene. Two was the role of the pastor.
Oh, okay.
Three is poor use of time. Four is the nominating. I'm only at four.
Okay.
The nominating process. Now, I don't know how all this works for you in your churches or boards, but this is how it's worked for me several times. Is either the week before or the day of the annual meeting, somebody pulls me aside and says, you know, we think you'd be really good on the church council. And we'd really like to put your name on the church council. And guess what? It really doesn't take much time. You really don't have to do much. And so, you know, but we really think that you'd be good. And so we're giving you all 30 minutes to make this decision. And, you know, it's just really not that big a deal. And, you know, and if you're new at this, you kind of feel like, well, it's not that big a deal, and I'm going to feel guilty if I say no. So you say yes. Then you find out that there's some sex scandal amongst the staff, and all of a sudden this is in the middle of your lap, and you're living this. And so they lied to you. They lack credibility. What, you know, the nominating process. Let me tell you what we tell our board members, the people we invite to come on our board. If you come on our board, this is going to be an awesome responsibility. You are going to have to spend a lot of time, work hard, and commit your heart to this ministry. And if you can't do those three things, then you probably don't want to be on this board. And guess what? We have a very high level expectation of attendance and commitment. And once you have that, I mean, it's hard to get there, but once you get there, it breeds that. We have people who want to be on our board. We have people at the end of their time crying because they're leaving our board because of the intense experience that they have in that board of how they poured their heart into that place. That's a whole different message. You know, you come, we're going to expect that you be here every fourth Tuesday night at 7 o'clock p.m. and sometimes we don't get out of here until 10:30. You're going to be expected to be probably on one of three working committees, and we also expect that you're going to come in twice a month and feed residents who can't feed themselves. Because until you do that, you'll never understand this organization. And I tell people I do orientation with, if you don't do garbology at Holden Village, you've never been to Holden Village. You don't understand this place until you go and sort garbage. And until you come and feed residents in our nursing home, you will not understand what this organization is about. And it takes a pretty special person to do that, but we have a high level functioning board.
What would be your suggestion then for that same analogy for a church?
Well, how does nominations happen? That's the kind of question. And I tend not to believe in nominating committees. I tend to believe in governance committees. And governance takes over all the issues of bylaws, nominations. So I take nominating committees. But let's just call it a nominating committee for a second. How is there a nominating committee? How does it work? And how is it empowered? What is its responsibility? And let me tell you, I like two different nominating committees. I like a nominating committee that has all the newest people onto the church council. Because they're the ones who come with the brightest and freshest eyes. And I'm also going to ask that the nominating committee, because we're going to talk a little bit about board officers and how board officers get appointed. So nominate committee, in my opinion, governance committee has that responsibility. Nominate new people to serve on the board and nominate the officers of the board. So when you have the brand newest people, if you brought four new people onto the church council, I think that's a great nominating committee. Because one, none of them should be officers. None of those people should be officers. because they just showed up. Now, the other nominating committee I like is the oldest four people and the people who are going to go out next year. Because those are the people who have the most experience and have the most sense about what their what this church council needs and who the leadership is. And most likely, they shouldn't be in an officer's position if they're on their way out. Or if they are, they're not going to be in a position to renominate themselves. So I recently met with a church council, and they had their first church council meeting, and the pastor asked me to come and to make a proposal about doing some strategic planning with them. And then at the end, they said, oh, by the way, we have to nominate officers. And so everybody sits around, and they say, oh, I think, Julie, you'd make a great president. Well, Julie doesn't want to be president. I mean, she doesn't want to be in the church council to begin with. So she says, Mark, you'd be a great president. And pretty soon they go around the room and they nominate everybody. Because it's obvious to me as I sit there that nobody wants to be president. So what do? They nominate somebody who's not there. Oh, yeah, George, he'd be a great president. Let's have him be president. Oh, yeah, he'd be great. You know, who's the one person who shouldn't be president of this organization? The person is not there, ends up being president. And then we say, why do we, at the end I said, do you guys feel good about this nominating process? You know? I mean, where are you grooming the leadership for your organization? Where's the commitment and the passion related to that? So that's how I think you get at it, is a governance committee. One other thing I'll just say, and I'm going to skip over this fairly quickly because I'm going to run out of time, is assumed council roles. One of the things that bothers me is, you know, you get the CPA in the church on the council, what's he become?
Treasurer.
Yeah, he's sick of treasuring. You know, I'm asked to be on there. People want one. I mean, I just get nominated to the board, then they say, you should be chair. Well, I don't want to be chair. I sit on enough boards. Well, you should be in charge of stewardship. That's what I do for a living, is raise money. You know, I really don't want to do. You know what I want to do in the church council? I want to be in charge of planting the flower boxes. You know, I'd actually like to come to church one day and say, I did that. I can see what I did. You know, but we assume people in roles. And you can't assume people in roles. I got a whole other piece on that, but I'm going to move on. Fifth reason, it's all about the building. When in the church council, what's it all about? It's not about the budget, it's all about the building. It's a focus on the building. Now, I said about my locked church. My argument at the church council was, we're being owned by our possessions. I mean, the church should be a haven, should be a safe place. If stuff is missing, that should be the least of our concern because it doesn't have a soul. You know, now we're going to be owned by our possessions. Now, when I was up here in 1990, I got the opportunity to work with Gerald Barney. Gerald wrote the President Carter's 2000 Global 2000 environmental report, and he wanted to have an environmental conference related to the church and the environment here. And so I got to Dr. Hossford. Scott Hossford was the director at that time, and I put together letters, and with Dr. Barney's help, we mailed out letters to everyone to come to a conference here at Holden Village about the church and the environment. The folks know who Wendell Berry is? Mm-hmm. Do you know who Wendell Berry is? Well, I love, this is the letter Wendell Berry sent back. I thank you for your invitation and I'm sorry to be unable to attend. For me, the problem is less with the Bible and interpretations of the Bible than with the organized churches, what Dr. Barney calls the building. The building nowadays is typically expensive to build and to maintain, expensively decorated, expensively comfortable, air-conditioned in summer, overheated in winter, sealed against the outside world in order to maintain comfort, surrounded by a large parking lot which is covered a few hours a week with expensive automobiles. Similar buildings house church schools, church leaders, church administrators, etc., etc. All of this is dependent upon the economic and industrial activities that Dr. Barney's letter deplores. Though some churches sometimes deplore some of these activities, they can only do so only by hypocrisy, hoping secretly that nobody will hear and agree. I don't see how one can be a Christian and not deplore all of these activities and try to bring them to an end. Which is pretty much to say I'm having trouble seeing how one can be a Christian and belong to a church. I suggest that organized Christianity will not be effective in opposing the evils that are destroying creation until it has the vision and the guts to unbuild itself.
Who is this guy?
Sincerely, Wendell Berry. He's an environmental author.
Well, he's passed away. I think he's passed
away. Has he passed away?
Yeah.
Well,
sounds like the argument I had last year before we renovated the church.
Well, that's, you know, I come and I said, you know, what's it about? It tends to be about the budget. It tends to be about the building. As far as I can tell, the church doesn't have anything to do. The building is but a tool, an asset, a resource to help the church fulfill its mission. But the building overtakes any sense of mission. And so it's all about the building. Number six, we fight over all the wrong things. Are most folks in here at ELCN? Raise your hand. Okay. What are the two things that are going to tear this church apart? What are the two things that are going to tear the ELCA apart?
Human sexuality.
Gay and lesbian issues. What's the second?
Well, ordination.
Call to common mission.
Call to common.
Those are the two things that are going to tear this church apart. You know, and so we just rant and rave about those two things. And, you know, I mean, I'm no Bible scholar, but I can't really find where that's much dealt with at all in the Bible. And, you know, Holden Village changed my life. I'm not gay. And I've become very sensitive to those who are and kind of understood their lifestyle. But for most people, I don't think most people give a rip. And the call to common mission, I mean, it's got people so up in arms that they're withholding their benevolence money to the church and to the Senate because they're going to have an Episcopal priest present at the ordination and when the bishop is installed to lay his or her hands on them. I mean, how does that affect any of you in the room? It might affect you if you're elected bishop. How many people
does this affect?
How many people does this affect in the room?
I think it falls under institutional memory.
Are you advocating going back to rice bowls and togas? The St. Francis Church?
No, I'm just saying that the things that people get their hair up on the back of their neck about and get all angry about and will split the church are relatively meaningless in terms of, here's what I want. I want to meet the first church that says we're going to withhold our benevolence to the Senate because they're not doing enough for the poor. I'm angry because our church is not doing enough for the poor. I read the Bible. I find all sorts of stuff about the poor in there. Does that get us all whipped up in a froth? You know, are we going to split the church because we're not doing enough for the work of Jesus Christ? No, we're whipped in a froth about stuff that doesn't matter to me, or is relatively minor. That isn't going to, you know, but those are the things that are going to break our church wide open, and that there's anger about. I met with a church council. They wanted, they invited me to come, and they really wanted three things. They wanted mission help. Then they wanted governance structure, and then they wanted strategic planning. But they thought they could get all that at once. And I said, no, you know, you really got to figure out where you're going to start and whether those three things you start with. And then there was this church council member who was sitting there when I was all done. And actually, I thought I did a pretty good job of kind of laying out the different stuff. And he says, I want to know what you're going to charge us. And I said, well, you know, I do a lot of consultations with hospitals about long-term care. And long-term care is my specialty, and a lot of hospitals are moving into long-term care. And if it's a project I really like, I charge $900 a day. If it's something I really don't care that much about, I charge $1,200 a day. But since we manage Lutheran Social Services, and you're an owner of Lutheran Social Services, it's free. Our governance training to you from our organization is free. So he kind of sat back. And so I finished my spiel and took a few more questions, and then they moved on. Now, here's the last order of business of this council meeting. The bishop was retiring. His name was Mark Ramseth, and they had established a fund in his name, an endowment fund, to help pay back young pastors who had college bills, seminary bills. And they were being called to these dinky little churches in Montana. They couldn't afford to pay him guideline. And Mark wanted to set up a fund. So now Mark was retiring. It's going to be his last Senate convention. He sends out a letter and says, there's going to be an offering to this endowment fund. And a letter went to each of the churches, and the pastor says, we got this letter from the Senate, and the Senate wanted to, send something. Well, this was also the same meeting where the new leadership had just been elected, so the new president is looking around, doesn't know what to do. And he says, is there like a suggested amount or anything? And then the pastor says this, a couple $100 would do. We send plenty of money to the Senate. So I sit back a little bit and I'm thinking, I'm doing, you've done okay, Ken, just keep your mouth shut. And then the guy who asked me, he stepped up and he said, I want to know where the Senate stands on this CCM thing. And until they get their act together, we're not going to send them a nickel. We're not going to send them anything. And I'm looking for some leadership here. This is the board president has just been elected. He says, well, I guess there's no motion. I guess we won't send anything. And I thought, and I raised my hand. And I said, remember I told you about the 900, 1200? Now it's 2,000. You want me to come back and work with this church? It's $2,000. And I'll give it all to the Mark Ramseth Fund. Because I work with those small churches and I know what this is about. And it has nothing to do with CCM. It has to do with seminary graduates who can't pay back their school loans and need to serve small rural congregations in Montana. That's, we argue and fight about all the wrong things. Mm-hmm. Now, needless to say, I've not ever been invited back to that church. Okay, that's number six. Number seven, a lack of benevolence. A lack of benevolence. Okay. Do you all have stewardship programs in your church? Okay. I mean, I've always had them in my churches. And they here's what they talk about. Do you ever hear about percentage giving? 3%, increased by 1% a year. First fruits. Does that language mean anything to anybody? Give first. Okay. So anyway, that's the mall. That's what's been preached to me. That's what the stewardship said. And see, I actually take the church seriously. So I think this is really serious. And then what happens to the church? Now December, and they don't have quite enough money, so they decide that they're going to pay all the salaries and utilities and all the bills, and whatever's left they'll send to the Senate Benevolence. Maybe only 25% or 50%, because that's sight unseen. Now, I was on a church council, my first church council, and this is exactly the situation of the church council. Came to the end of the year, we didn't have enough money. Treasurer comes in, he's all consumed by the budget. He's got the budget there, and this is it, and he's got trends, he's got graphs, and they're in four colors. And he says, and the decision is made that, we're not going to pay the Senate benevolence. Because why? Because we send the Senate plenty of money. Well, I manage Lutheran Social Services in our state, and a fourth of our budget comes from the Senate. So when the churches withhold money from the Senate, that means adoptions aren't needed, counseling doesn't happen, things don't happen. But people don't see a disconnect there. So I'm on my first church council, and I support this decision because I got a business degree, and this is good business. And the pastor comes in, and he hears this decision, and he says, no. The Senate benevolence check is the first check written. And I've met with the staff and none of us will be paid in December until the benevolence check is paid. And left. And we're all sitting there going, he said, and if you cut me, if you cut me a check, I won't catch it. And neither will the rest of the staff. It wasn't a very big staff. Now, so the council president gets up at church on Sunday and says, well, this is kind of where we're at financially, and our pastor, who is beloved, is refusing to be paid until the benevolence is paid first. That church was rolling in money. I mean, so much money came in because, why? People did not want their pastor not to be paid. They could care less about the benevolence. And to me, that became a historic moment. Now, here we are, the end of the fourth quarter, Montana Senate, budget isn't making amends. So we all get a letter, all the social service agencies get a letter saying, we don't look like we have enough money, we're gonna have to cut your allocation in half by December. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sitting in the pew. What's this first fruit stuff? I mean, I'm supposed to live this out, but my church doesn't live it out, and then my Senate doesn't live it out. Why doesn't the church live it out? The Senate, you know, if we're not going to live it, then don't preach it. So I, you know, we preach benevolence, we don't live benevolence. That's number seven. Number eight, and I'm going to be okay here, I think, in eight more minutes, is I want to know who cares for the pastor. You know, the pastor is supposed to care for everybody else, and maybe you have a personnel committee. And I don't know if the personnel committee, you know, does evaluations, and my experience is they all fumble over those and don't know how to do those. And we could spend a whole series on, you know, how do we deal with difficult personnel issues in churches. I mean, we have a wonderful call process to bring pastors on board, but we have no process to get rid of them. So that's when things get really ugly, and we have not, as a church, been very sophisticated about doing that. And I think that's an area the church needs to work on. But aside from that, I want to know who cares for the pastor. Now, a lot of pastors I know have been, you know, have went out and selected kind of a 5 or 4 or 3 or 6 people to sit on a kind of pastoral care committee that doesn't have anything to do with evaluating their performance. It has to do with supporting the pastor. Asking the pastor what's going on in his or her life. And seeing how they're doing. So here's my experience, and especially in the Highline in eastern Montana. That's a state that's in economic distress. The young people have all left the rural communities. We're in a drought. And the communities are getting smaller and they're aging. There's tough economic times. There's a lot of alcohol addiction, rising incidence of male suicide. Now, ultimately, what this boils down to is the people living there are very, very angry at God because they played by all the rules. They did everything they were supposed to do. They played by all the rules, and the promise is not coming true, and it's getting worse. But guess what? People don't know how to be angry at God, so who are they angry at?
The pastor.
The pastor. The pastor in most of these small towns, the Lutheran pastor, is the single most educated person in that community. Has more skills and a better education and has more counseling ability than anybody else in that community. So all the garbage gets dumped on their front porch. And as I go out and work with church councils and churches, I'm finding pastors who need to be pastored too. Now, in our Senate, or in our state, actually the Catholics have it much better. They have what they call the Vicar of Priests. Anybody know what that is? It's a priest to priests. Vicar of Priests. I love it. The Vicar of Priests of the Catholic Diocese of Montana sits on one of our boards. And his job is to be priest to the priests. What's the bishop get to be? Boss to the priests. Is to deal with all the garbage. You know, so number eight, within congregations, ask yourself, who's caring for the pastor? Who's taking care of the pastor? And in the last 4 minutes, the ninth reason is that we preach a God of abundance. and we live as if we had a God of scarcity. I mean, we talk about abundance, we talk about God, and then we live exactly opposite. And see, I actually think passing a deficit budget is a theologically wonderful thing to do. That's believing in a God of abundance. Now, if the money doesn't come, then maybe you really didn't need it. Maybe you made some bad decisions. But people who say the church got to be run like a business, it's not a business. I love passing a deficit budget. I love stepping out and taking some risks in mission. Now, I'm smart enough not to take stupid risks and things, but if there's a margin for hope or possibility, then it ought to be God's people who step up and take it. But yet, it tends to be God's people who take the last step. And so we live as a God, as if we had a God of scarcity, but we preach a God of abundance. And I've just found it's a lot funner to believe in a God of abundance and live that way, organizationally. 2 minutes left. Any questions?
you know any churches doing it right?
I don't know that they're. I've worked well. I get called into churches that are doing it wrong. So I guess I seldom get called into churches that are doing it right. I would guess there are. On a scale of 1 to 10, everybody's somewhere between a 2 and a 9. There are some people who are doing it very, very well. They tend to struggle when they go through some kind of growth barrier, when they go from adding additional staff or go through a building project, when they really kind of in their growth stage of their church, they'll take a blip in the road. I do another session where I say, here's where you are, and this is where you want to be, right? This is where you want to go. Where do you got to go first? Here. There's pain and struggle. People want change, they want improvement, they don't want pain and struggle. And if you're here and you want to go here, you're going to have to go here first on the graph. And that's painful. And those become significant times of change for congregations. And some are able to manage that better. Some, and I would say, in some cases, it's not the bigger the church does better. Sometimes bigger churches have business managers. Who make and run one decisions, and so you think bigger is better. But my sense is smaller often creates better communication. Actually, the best churches I've worked with have been the very smallest, the pastoral churches. Whereas the pastor is the staff, and the church council is pretty in tune. Everybody knows each other. Those, I think, do relatively well. It's when they move into a growing or more middle size, when they're talking about adding staff, and all of a sudden it raises huge questions about who evaluates who and who's making what decision. I find churches struggling in that area. My sense is I've never seen a perfectly managed organization. Of the four organizations I manage, we're far from perfect in any four of them.
Have you read that book, Transforming Church Boards? I think it is Spiritual Leaders, it's called.
I haven't.
It really helped us, and I think transformed our council meetings this last year, making them more worshipful work. We adopted kind of a worship format. We would intersperse prayer and confession. Not that it was a major part, but rather than having prayers as bookends, we remind us why were we there, what was our whole purpose, and it really changed the flavor, and I think it moved us along in our business and so forth.
One of the things we've done in our organization is engraved whatever the mission of the four organizations are in stone and hung it on the wall wherever the board meets, and fundamentally, here's the issue. Is board members are trained to say, what does this have to do with our mission? What does this conversation or this decision have to do with our mission? If it doesn't have anything to do with our mission, why is it on our agenda? And then, you know, every 3 or 4 years, all of our boards go into have a knockdown, drag-out fight about why we exist as an organization. What's the mission? And once we establish that mission, so we try to intertwine that mission through everything we do, every decision that's made, every conversation. And our boards have gotten sophisticated enough now that they just, and administration's got sophisticated. I mean, I tell my own staff, don't show up there unless you can tie this into mission. And you better be able to speak why it enhances the mission of our organization. And we have a 7-year strategic plan. In our organization, and every point in that strategic plan ties back to the mission. And
how often do you think a mission should be rewritten?
I think it depends on the relevancy of the mission. I mean, is it alive? You know, can people state it? I mean, one of the first things I do start is to come in and say, what's the mission of your organization? It has something to do with God's people. I think we do good things and hope and charity and love, something like that. Then I would say the time is now. Mission of our organization, our identity statement is St. John's Lutheran Ministries is a community of diverse people sharing God's healing presence. That's who we are. Our mission is to provide living opportunities within nurturing environments of hope, dignity, and love. I would expect executive leadership and boards to be able to rattle off every word of the mission statement. If they can't, then I would guess the mission statement is not relevant. Now, in our case, we have these knockdown battles, and we've only changed the mission statement. We've modified our mission statement twice in 9 years. And one modification was we went from nurturing environment to nurturing environments. We added an S to the word environment. Why? Because we were now managing 4 organizations around the state. It took a day and a half for us to add an S to the word environment. But the process was important because everybody understood the mission. Did that. And then the second one we added, we have what we call commitment statements. Other people would maybe call them values. We call them commitment statements. And we added a commitment statement. Nurturing faith-driven partnerships as part of that statement, because that was the time in which we were talking about developing a joint venture partnership with the Catholic hospital. And we said, our value statements don't really speak to this. And the faith-driven part was, well, probably our organization, we own a great corner in Billings, Montana. If I put a McDonald's on that corner, we'd make a ton of money. But I'm not sure how I'd sell that to the board about why that was a faith-driven partnership.
You talk about not needing any more churches, but do you ever get the feeling that you're part of an organization that is so hidebound and so stuck in the past and such a dinosaur that the years it will take to sort of get that organization going in what you see as a positive direction isn't worth the effort, and it's better to hop over here and start something else?
You're talking about the church.
Well, you could apply this in a lot of realms, but let's talk about mission.
If it was in the church, my sense is, and I've got to quit here since it's 6:05, it steps back, and one, you have to just name it. I mean, does somebody have the courage to be able to step up? That's about leadership development, the courage to say, we're mired in the same old rut, we're going nowhere, we don't know what the mission of the organization is. It takes usually some kind of catalyst to break an organization out of the rut that it's in. I'd much prefer that kind of transformative sort of experience happen than, 30 families get upset, split off, to form a new church. So we build another building with another parking lot, with another, what Wendell Berry said, that's what I see. There's a road, it's Church Row down from our nursing home. And, I can't imagine that there's going to be another church built there. And guess what the cities are starting to do? The cities are saying, all these churches want fire protection. They don't pay any taxes. You know, I mean, one of the things I think we need to do is start having churches pay a fire district tax. So I'm going to quit because we have a 6:15 session in here, but thanks for all coming. I appreciate it.